Being the Wednesday, April 20, 2005, public hearing on House Bill 5038. This is a joint committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. We'll be reviewing Phase 2 budget issues on Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. We'll begin with an overview by our Legislative Fiscal Officer, Sheila Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. In front of you, you should have my memo with some overview information, and I'll walk through that in a minute. There's the governor's recommended budget presentation that Jan Dean will be making, and then there is also Department of Human Services priority list, requested information on select priorities. If you remember when we went through the priority list process, there were some programs that the subcommittee highlighted and ones that they wanted to have more information on and to discuss more as we went through phase two. And so this is what the department put together, and it's my understanding the agency will be referring to that as we go through the phase two presentations. And there are also a couple additional handouts that you'll get as we get to the appropriate place in the discussion. Didn't want to overwhelm you with too much paper right at the start of the meeting. So we expect to discuss the phase two piece for CAF today and tomorrow. And then, as we noted yesterday, public testimony, we would expect Monday and Tuesday. Monday, trying to focus on the self-sufficiency programs and vocational rehabilitation services. And then Tuesday, having public testimony on the child welfare programs. So if you want to go to the memo from me, it's dated April 19th. I'll go through that, try to go through that fairly quickly. I've noted the mission for these programs, this budget cluster of the agency, and that's to improve family capacity to be self-sustaining while creating a safe and permanent living environment for children. Primary programs and customers, there are three major program areas, self-sufficiency, child welfare, and vocational rehabilitation services. And there's a little chart there that is intended to refresh your memory about the major programs in each of those program areas. So self-sufficiency, the biggest programs include food stamps, temporary assistance to needy families, cash assistance predominantly, jobs, employment, and training, employment-related daycare, the refugee program, and then prevention services. Child welfare includes child protective services, domestic violence and sexual assault grants, foster care, and other types of out-of-home care, residential treatment, and adoptions. Vocational rehabilitation, we heard, in addition to the basic vocational rehabilitation services, they also operate a youth transition services program. They fund supported employment services and then the independent living program. In terms of primary customers, CAF serves families and adults with disabilities through the vocational rehabilitation programs who need help to become employed or self-sufficient, and they serve abused, neglected, and or dependent children and their families. Other customers include service providers, of which there are many, of course, including foster care providers, treatment providers, employment and training providers, daycare providers, providers of rehabilitation services, adoption agencies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They also have customers at the local level, local nonprofit organizations, schools, and other partners in the community. Major policy and budget issues. The first bullet there refers to the fact that federal reauthorization of the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families Program, TANF, is still uncertain. It's been 2.5, almost 3 years now since that program expired in 2002. It's been operating on a series of federal continuing resolutions. However, neither House nor Senate has passed a bill yet, so we don't know what form that program will take. I do believe, however, that they are closer to passing a bill this year than they have been in prior years. Both the House and the Senate seem to have viable versions of bills that they're working on. So we will wait and see what happens with that. One of the issues, my understanding, is one of the issues on the federal reauthorization, why it seems so critical to get it enacted this year, is that if it's not enacted, it may get tied up in the overall federal budget reduction process for the discretionary portion of the federal budget. And so we may be looking at less funding overall for the program than is currently the case. On the top of the second page, I've noted that there are maintenance of effort requirements, particularly in the federal TANF program and vocational rehabilitation programs. There are also maintenance of effort requirements in the Child Care and Development Grant program that's administered by Employment Department, but the bulk of the funding is spent in the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families budget. So that comes into play as well. If we don't meet the minimum state program funding levels that are required under those maintenance of effort requirements, we can jeopardize federal program funds. And I would note that at this point in the governor's budget, it appears that we are meeting or would be expected to meet the TANF maintenance of effort requirement, but that's not the case with the basic 110 grants that fund the vocational rehabilitation programs. It seems like we're about $1 million short there. So that's an issue that the subcommittee will want to be aware of. And then the third bullet under the major issues is, of course, the big picture child welfare issue. CAS is responsible for safety, permanency, and well-being for children who are abused, neglected, or at significant risk. And as we heard in the Phase 1 presentations, there are a number of issues surrounding that, including increased complexity of family needs, such as the increased prevalence of meth use with the parents or caregivers, limited state and local resources for prevention, early intervention, and treatment programs. For example, when families are coming through and need alcohol and drug treatment or mental health treatment so that they can address the issues that make it difficult for them to care for their children safely, you need to have the resources to address those needs. Another issue is caseworker and related staffing levels and workload. As there are more reports of abuse, that doesn't always get translated into more staffing, and it is a workload issue for the agency. And then I've noted child welfare information system supports as an issue as well. As we heard in the department-wide support services discussion, the budget in that cluster includes funding to replace the statewide automated child welfare information system, the SACWIS program. But that does, obviously, what happens with that program has a bearing on how CAF does its work. Budget notes, emergency board actions, and audit findings. There was only one budget note that directly related to CAF, and that was related to the Jobs Plus program. In the last budget, separately identified funding for the Jobs Plus program was eliminated, but the department was basically given the go-ahead to continue operating the Jobs Plus program within the funding for the Jobs program overall. And so this budget note just wanted to make clear that that was the case. The second bullet talks about what happened during the interim in this budget. It notes the disappropriation that the budget cluster took with the defeat of Measure 30, $12 million general fund. There were budget rebalancing actions in April 2004 and November 2004, and those included what I would call the typical program caseload and cost adjustments. There were also general fund reductions for personal services and services and supply savings that had been identified for about $10 million in federal funds carried forward from the prior biennium and one-time TANF high-performance bonuses. There were two bonuses that the agency received totaling about $6 million. And I note those things here not just in the context of what happened during the interim with the emergency board, but also as we're moving forward in the budget. Even though those were general fund savings for the current biennium, unless those are repeated again this biennium, we don't expect that the general fund savings will be there. And so you will see some backfill amounts as they're building the budget, using general fund to replace these one-time federal funds. And then I note that the last Secretary of State audit that was directly related to CAF programs wasn't during the current biennium, but was completed at the end of the last biennium. It was a review of the temporary assistance for needy families eligibility process and determinations, and I've attached a copy of that for your information. Basically, the bottom line was it said that there were some errors that they noted, but they were within the realm of reasonable, and that's just the best way that I would characterize it. But you can review that if you wish to. The next paragraph deals with the revenue sources. This budget, as you can tell if you're looking at the dollar amounts, it's primarily federal funds, and most of those federal funds are from food stamps. So almost $1 billion comes from food stamps in this budget. TANF, Foster Care and Adoption Assistance, Medicaid, and Vocational Rehabilitation Act funds are the largest other federal funds. Other funds are predominantly federal child care and development funds that this budget receives from the Employment Department, so they're recorded as other funds in this budget. Then only 19% of the budget is general fund. At the bottom of page 2 and continuing on to the next page.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Baker, on the LFO analysis, there's general fund, other fund, federal funds, and federal funds NL.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, federal funds NL means federal funds non-limited. Budgetarily, we make a distinction between federal funds for which the legislature establishes an expenditure limitation and federal funds that are primarily out of the agency's control but which we want to show a budget for, but they're non-limited in the sense that the agency can administratively increase that limitation without legislative approval. Although for this department, they normally come in and bring that forward in their budget rebalancing. But the distinction is between federal funds, and in this case, those are all food stamp benefit dollars, federal funds that the agency doesn't really control. Food stamps is an entitlement program. The benefits are 100% federally funded, and so we've established that as a non-limited line item for them. And then the rest of the federal funds is reflecting the more typical operating funds, administrative reimbursements, federal grant funds, things that are within the agency's control.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Ms. Baker, so that's very helpful. Thank you. But the document we're looking at today lists food stamps at 933 and the non-limited federal funds in the analyst's report at 874. Is it just not an exact? I mean, I'm trying to make it too exact? Or?
Well, part of the difference would be that the 874 non-limited is the amount that gets paid out in benefits. The 933 that I've referenced in my memo is the overall revenues that are expected, some of which would be administrative reimbursement and would be in that federal funds limited line item. So I guess an easier way to say that is the 874 is part of the 933, but there are additional food stamp administrative reimbursement dollars that fall within the limited budget.
That come from the $755 million out of the other federal funds.
Correct,
okay.
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Okay, moving to the governor's recommended budget then on the bottom of page 2. I tried to summarize this, and for more detail, again, you can look at our LFO analysis, and for those out in the audience that aren't aware of that, that is on the legislative webpage linking with the fiscal office and then with our publication, so you can access it that way. But I've tried to be high level here, but there's a lot going on in this budget, and so I'll walk you through that, and we'll hear more from the Budget Management Division and then the agency. The first paragraph there just gives a bunch of numbers, but the bottom line for me is that although there's a 2% total funds growth in this budget, that's totally due to growth in the non-limited food stamps line item. If you took that non-limited food stamps line item out of their budget and looked at the operating budget overall, they would actually be slightly less than their current 2003-05 legislatively approved. So instead of $2.134 billion, they'd be at $2.13 billion. So to get to that level, the governor's budget makes some significant program reductions, about $50 million in general fund reductions, and those are bulleted there. It affects the first month copayment for employment-related daycare families, new ones coming on, and effective May 2006, it would limit employment-related daycare to only families leaving TANF. It would eliminate job support services to at-risk families as opposed to families on the TANF cash assistance caseload. It would limit support services to families in transition, and overall it would further reduce the jobs program by 2.5%. It limits support services for the food stamp employment and training program to transportation only. It limits TANF eligibility for children who are cared for by non-parent relatives to households at or below 150% of the federal poverty level. It reduces domestic violence program funding, and that's TANF domestic violence services, so that's part of the overall TANF program.
Is the limitation of non-parent relatives to households at or below 150 down from 185?
No, it is. The proposal was made in two pieces, one to limit it to 185 and one to limit it to 150. And what the governor's budget does, currently my understanding is there is no income limit, and this establishes an income limit at 150% of federal poverty level. So the next bullet would be reduce child welfare system of care flexible funding. This is associated with a previous agreement with the Juvenile Rights Project and other advocates in terms of how you provide services to children in the foster care system or at risk of foster care. The special rates payments for foster care would be reduced by 20%. Special payments for basic rehabilitative services, so the rehabilitation services piece, is reduced, and that's about a $2 million reduction. And as I noted, with the governor's budget reduction, we're below the maintenance of effort requirement for that program. As with other Department of Human Services budgets, the cost of living adjustment, the COLA, the 2.4% standard inflationary increase, is delayed until January 2006. And then general fund that had been used to support abstinence education and the community safety net prevention programs is eliminated. So there's only federal funds remaining for those programs. In addition to the program reductions, I've noted there's reductions in staff and other administrative costs. More than 200 positions, actually 201 positions by my count, related to current and projected program growth is not funded in the governor's budget. It eliminates 82 positions that are in the current legislatively approved budget. There are 80 positions for what we consider to be mandated programs, which would be food stamps and foster care, that are not funded, that normally would have been funded without the budget constraints we're facing.
Are these positions that are presently being funded, and so people will be laid off, or are these just taking away positions that are on paper?
The 82 positions are presently funded. Most of those, I believe, are not filled, but there may be some that are. The 80 positions are not funded. They were, as the agency builds the budget, in the essential packages, you will see an increase of 80 positions in the mandated caseload package. Those aren't filled positions. What the governor's budget says is, well, you know, regardless of whether we consider those mandated or not, we're not going to fund those positions. So those would have been new positions in 2005-07. And then there are 39 other positions that the agency requested to address expected caseload increases in other programs, which we consider to be non-mandated. That is, we wouldn't normally automatically add staff there. And that includes TANF, employment-related daycare, and other child welfare programs. CAF has implemented some efficiencies over the last several years, and the staffing study that we talked about in the context of the DWSS budget may have some information in terms of helping to evaluate whether these program reductions are good, bad, or neutral in terms of the food stamps and the Medicaid eligibility staff. But it's, I did want to note that there are those 200 positions there that in previous biennium we might have expected to see in the governor's budget.
Sure. Representative Henson.
When is the staffing study scheduled to be completed?
The draft report is scheduled for the end of May, so we should have some information with that. I believe the final report is mid-July or something like that, which, not that I don't love you, but I hope that it will be too late for this session. Mm-hmm. But I expect that the draft report will have some information that we can use.
Significant aggravation that report, that particular timing is very difficult for us in the budget preparation. I don't quite understand why we would go to the time and effort to do that type of a study and have it fall in place, hopefully when the legislature's already left. But I'll be very interested in seeing the draft report in May.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
A couple questions real quick. I'll make an assumption, Sheila, that we will have an opportunity as we really get into these budgets to talk about what these static positions have, especially for my interest on children at risk and children who are at risk for being abused, especially children under the age of 6 and as our biggest areas are kids under the age of 1. So I'm making an assumption we're going to have a chance to really talk that over before we get out of this building. The second thing I'm going to tag on to what Representative Hansen said, the staffing issue was one which we, and I think the chair chairs this with me, we really fought hard to get that staffing study done. Some of us are completely opposed to the way it is being done. We think it's going to be something that is not of very much value to us. We think that it might even be a waste of money. I'll hold that comment until I actually see the staffing study. But I made it very clear from the beginning that I thought this should go on one particular path, be done by an outside source, by people who have expertise in doing these types of things from the business world. And I am not full of great expectations for what this staffing report is going to tell us. It's typical that it'll come late, it'll come around a session, and I think it'll be inadequate. I might be surprised, and I hope I am. But it's been sort of swept under the carpet as something that, while some of us felt very strongly about it, and last summer and fall, while we were busy running campaigns and doing other things, this thing was pushed aside and pushed aside and pushed aside, and finally an RFP was put out which I thought was inadequate, and which asked the wrong questions and brought in the wrong people. There are those on our side of the debate who feel that the staffing study not only will not be effective, but it'll prevent us from being an effective one in the future, which is even worse. So I want some caveats when that study comes out. We know how we feel. Mr. Chair, you and I disagree on a lot of things in this building, but I don't think we disagree in this one.
Not at all. In fact, the work was actually finished, I think, February. And I'm wondering why it's going to be the end of May when, you know, it's not like you're waiting for additional data. Did you have a steering committee meeting recently?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we have a steering committee meeting this afternoon, in fact. I will just say that the difficulty, I think, in getting it underway is that it took some time for people to agree, even with those who disagreed, but it took some time to get agreement on how to proceed and what the scope of the study was. And the agency did come back to the emergency board and worked with the members of the subcommittee to try and get some agreement and move forward on it. So, in fact, the contract was only awarded in January of this year. And looking at the areas that the staffing study is looking at, which is food stamp, Medicaid eligibility, and adult protective services, there are varying amounts of information out there for the contractor to get and then to look at how the department is doing its work and come up with recommendations. I do think that the study would have been completed earlier if the department would have had a better sense earlier on exactly what direction it needed to move in. But that having been said, I think that the current...
Very kind.
Well, having sat in on
the question about
the
where
steering
they
committee
wanted
meeting.
To go or where the legislature wanted them to go. Anyway, I know that you were involved in that meeting.
Yeah.
We're very frustrated that there's $300,000 that had been spent on a company. We hope that'll do a good job, but it has other contracts with DHS, which makes there an inherent conflict of interest as far as the independence. We hope that they're able to overcome that, and we'll be anxious to hear the results of your meeting this afternoon.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilson.
If I could just point out to the now vacant Senator Bates, this will be the most comprehensive and cognitive sentence that he has ever understood.
That he's never not heard.
Yeah, that he's never not heard. I was just going to say, I think because of some of your efforts and others on the committee, Mr. Chair, all good things come to those who wait, and by the end of the biennium in the 74th session, we will have some interesting results on this and many other issues. So, thank you, sir.
Thank you. And let's press on.
Move along. Okay. In the middle of the third page, then, we're on what the governor's budget does fund. The governor's budget does include policy packages to increase attorney general representation for child welfare workers in court hearings. And we've had a little bit of discussion on that, but I know the agency will talk about that more in their phase two discussion. There are, together with staff in the department-wide support services budget, which we heard about, there are additional staff in this budget cluster to increase overpayment collections, and in this budget you will see the net $2.9 million general fund savings. There are, again, in a connection with the department-wide support services staff, there are additional staff here for Medicaid quality control reviews, as we talked about, new regulations, requiring more intense and more frequent reviews.
Can you remind us to get information on where that $2.9 million of general fund anticipated savings from this increased overpayment collections would come from? Why not $2.5 million? Why not $4.0 million? I mean, how do you determine that? So I'd like to get that clarified.
And then there's a package that is associated with the reinstatement of the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program, funded with provider taxes and matching federal funds. The eligibility workers for that program are in this CAF budget. And so there's a package in there that funds those positions. And finally, I noted there are some fund shifts that are anticipated in the governor's budget. The domestic violence and sexual assault grant programs have been funded, at least in part, with criminal fines and assessment account monies. The governor's budget proposes to shift those criminal fines and assessment account programs, not only in this budget but in others, shift the funding from CFAA to the general fund. But in that process, there is also a 10% net reduction in those grant amounts. And then the last bullet there reflects the fact that the governor's budget uses $3.4 million of fund balances from Jobs Plus individual education accounts related to the Jobs Plus program and individuals going through that, and the law enforcement medical liability account. It redirects that $3.4 million to replace general funds. So there's general fund savings by using those account balances in the programs. This is similar to what was done during the 2001-2003 interim during the special sessions as a budget-saving measure. However, I note there that the shifts require substantive legislation. We can't only do it in a budget bill. There's substantive legislation that needs to be amended as well. And to my knowledge, there's been no legislation introduced to do that yet. And so that wraps up my comments on their budget.
Okay, that one issue we also need to clarify with the governor's office as to why where that stands. Either the governor's recommended there be legislation, or he doesn't really mean it, or the co-chairs have decided not to do it, or leadership hasn't, so I don't know where that's at.
Mr. Chair, as far as the co-chair's budget, they did not propose restoring any of that general fund, and so the sense is that that's something that's agreed upon from their budget perspective, but yes, it needs legislation to move forward.
Okay, who will propose and ensure that there's a bill when the time comes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I've notified Budget Management and the Department that there needs to be legislation, and perhaps they'll be able to inform us.
Okay. We're excited to go forward. Let's find out all the answers to these and other questions that confront this committee. Moving ahead, Jan Dean, would you like to come forward
and
answer this myriad of questions that we've got?
We are inquiring minds.
Yes, I see that. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Dean. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division. Did you want me to go ahead and proceed with the overview or answer a couple of quick questions, or how would...
Why don't we go ahead with the overview, but having witnessed this, you know, the inquisitiveness that we have in mind, please just anticipate our questions whenever you get a chance.
I look forward with great anticipation to those questions. And I will go through this very quickly. Sheila covered a lot of the same ground, and as you know, these presentations are at a very high level, and the department then fills in a lot of the details, so I will move through very quickly. I know you're familiar with the charts on page 2, and I will just point out again that DHS is 98% of the all-funds budget for this program area for the state. On page 3, the key elements of this cluster's contribution toward the human service principle include support for family stability and permanency, and by helping vulnerable Oregonians with basic food and shelter needs. Page 4 just gives you that chart that gives you a comparison of cluster budget size, and at $2.2 billion, CAPS budget is 23% of DHS's total funds budget. Excuse me. Page 5 shows the cluster's budget by fund type. Non-limited funds, as Sheila mentioned, are the food stamp benefits, which are 100% federally funded. Federal funds regular federal funds include federal fund food stamps, administrative costs, TANF, Medicaid, foster care and adoption assistance, Vocational Rehabilitation Act. And then the other funds besides the child care development funds are overpayment recoveries and fees for licensing. Page 6 shows you the budget categories, of which special payments for this cluster's budget is about 75% of the budget. They include TANF cash assistance, food stamp benefits, employment-related daycare, and the foster care and adoption payments. Page 7, this chart, as you know, is intended to provide a funding comparison over time. Because the governor's recommended budget merges community human services and CAF, the budget system's records don't provide the information to compare across biennium. The increase in funding and positions is a result of that transfer from other parts of the department, primarily that merger, and it is not due to significant increases in positions or funding. And in fact, this budget is, as Sheila mentioned, slightly less when you remove the non-limited, and it is also slightly less with position authority. Page 8 highlights some of the policy and budget issues for this cluster, and Sheila did a great job of going over that, and then the department will provide greater detail during its presentation. The only thing I would add, I think, on this page to what Sheila has already said, I think she did touch on the fact that there may need to be changes in Oregon's program based on what Congress does finally adopt with TANF. And then I also wanted to point out the governor's child welfare initiatives. The critical incident protocol was developed during this current biennium to improve timely responses to serious incidents, increase the department's accountability, and strengthen its ability to improve the system as well as standardize the procedures that they use when a critical incident does occur. Page 9, again, Sheila touched on the overpayment collection staff, and I believe that the employees in the pilot recovered approximately $25,000 a month in overpayments, which does project to the 2.9 net savings of general fund. And then finally, I would just
wait, could you go over those numbers again? It's 25 a month. It comes up to how much?
There's a net savings of general fund of 2.9 for the forecasted for the 2005-07 biennium. So expenses, as I understand it, are reduced from overpayment. And then the net savings is that 2.9. So the cost of the positions, et cetera, will be reduced from the collections, and then that's where the 2.9 figure comes from.
Okay. Would you break that down again for me? You said $25,000 a month. Mm-hmm. That includes what? Is that net, or is that a gross savings or recovery, or what was that?
My understanding is that's a gross recovery amount.
Okay, so that's $1.2 million in a biennium. That's right. It's $25,000 a month. So, no, it'd be less than that, wouldn't it? That'd be $600,000 in a biennium.
I believe this package also...
1.2.
Bruce has his calculator.
Mr. Chair, I believe that part of the savings...
A year, so it's $600,000 a biennium, but then she jumped to a 2-point-something million in life loss.
And the net is the 25. I've just been corrected. It grossed $50,000 to $60,000 a month. The net is $25,000. And in addition, I believe...
So the overhead is 50%. I mean, that's what we're going to be... We'll discuss this, I guess, when... Whatever you like. Okay, we'll come back to it. Just continue.
Would you like to begin?
Well, we'll focus on that in a little bit. So you go ahead.
Okay. I also wanted to point out the reorganization that does consolidate CAF and Community Human Services clusters, and Community Human Services was the field structure. Finally, on the last page, I don't believe any of these reductions were not covered by Sheila, so if you have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Are there any questions? Thank you for the overview. Were there questions that came up that you ultimately should be the one to answer that came up in the preliminary discussion?
You, I think possibly the one about the bill, as bill for this would be, my understanding is, Sheila did mention that she has brought it to our attention, budget management, LFO, the governor's office, and the department are working on a solution and a bill for this is my understanding.
All right. It's in the works.
Yes.
Thank you. All right. We can go into... Phase two presentation, Mala Foley and Jim Neely.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Ramona Foley. For the record, I'm an assistant director at the Department of Human Services with an area called Children, Adults, and Families. And we wanted to start today in the section of your books. There's a page one, and this is under the tab that says Phase 2 Detailed Budget Discussion for CAF. And you also will have a handout that we will refer to as we go forward this morning and tomorrow. The handout cover looks like this. And what this document is our attempt to respond to some of the questions that you all had as you did your own priorities around the budget. There was the need to drill down and have a little more detail on certain areas, especially where there was a wide variance in how you ranged a particular item. And so that's what we've tried to capture with this. And we'll try to remember to refer to this as we talk a little bit about the programs during Phase 2. And at this time, I think Jim Neely is going to start us on the TANF discussion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Neely with Children, Adults, and Families.
What I'll do is run through the first self-sufficiency programs here. And again, this is to be still at a high level, and then later this morning we'll get into the more detailed discussions on each of these programs. TANF reauthorization in terms of a budget driver is likely to be an issue for us during the biennium. Congress, again, is working on reauthorizing the TANF program, which, as Sheila mentioned, had been expired since 2003. And we anticipate, based on what we've seen so far in terms of the reauthorization efforts, several bills have been proposed, that there will be a number of changes in the TANF program that require us to do things differently, which will include considerably more emphasis on work attachment activities, which tend to be more expensive and have more expensive support services such as child care associated with them. We'll talk more about that in the TANF and jobs program discussion later this morning.
Do you think that there, as you watch what's happening with the federal government, that as we look at a renewal of our own waiver, that it would be positively received, that to assure that individuals that are receiving benefits are able to work, that there be a drug-free requirement or drug treatment requirement? I guess I'm being contacted by employers who are saying, we would love to hire more people, but they can't pass drug tests. And so we know that there's a huge problem with meth and others. And so one way, so we have to approach it in multiple facets. One is through the judiciary and fear. Another is to try and motivate people to get into treatment and care, and if their benefits were connected with a presumption that the taxpayers' subsidies should not be utilized to promote illegal activities such as drug use. Just from your sense of it, what do you think the likelihood would be, or the possibility of having people be motivated to be into drug treatment as part of benefit packages?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the TANF program currently, while both of our senators are, I believe, pushing very hard to allow us to, for there to be a provision that we can renew our waiver. Thus far, the rest of Congress does not seem inclined to do that. Nevertheless, we already currently, and I believe even if our waiver were not renewed, require individuals that have drug and alcohol issues to participate in treatment to resolve those issues. And if they refuse, their grants will be sanctioned in progressive steps.
How do you know whether there are those issues?
Mr. Chair, primarily those issues come out when they're not self-disclosed, and sometimes they are self-disclosed, but when they're not, they tend to manifest themselves in terms of our clients' inability to participate in other job participation requirements. They don't show up for class, or they don't show up for worksite training, or whatever it is. Those are the typical indicators, and when our case managers see those indicators, they may require that someone undergoes a professional assessment in that regard, and if indeed that assessment says, yes, this person has an issue, then we will require that they participate in that treatment, or they will no longer be eligible.
Well, my understanding from phase one was that 80% of children going into foster care have drug and alcohol-related issues with their parents. And I don't know if that number was accurate or not, but if it's anything near that, then it means that we've got a huge problem that is not being dealt with, and so I'm just searching for additional ways that we can motivate treatment to take place.
Mr. Chair, no question that drug and alcohol issues play a large role in our business. In terms of the TANF program specifically, however, I think we're pretty well covered in terms of our policies and statutes.
Okay, thank you.
Can I follow up?
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does that mean if someone qualifies, they've pre-tested? Have they done like a like like we would an employer, you would do a drug test. If they've pre-qualified for TANF, have they done a drug test?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, no, we don't pre-test. We don't automatically do drug tests with applicants.
So when you say you think you're pretty well covered, you're pretty well covered, in a sense, you're hoping if they do have a problem and it shows up, that one of the workers then recommends. There's nothing that says you have to.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I think what we've discovered in the TANF program as it has moved from an income maintenance program into literally an employment program is that on the one hand there are a number of folks in the general population out there not receiving our services who have drug and alcohol issues who are able to maintain employment and take care of their families, and at least in the robust employment market that we had during the 90s, we saw that absolutely to be the case. These days, we're finding more and more folks who have difficulty participating in the jobs program, and in those cases, we immediately begin to look for why aren't they participating, and drug and alcohol issues are often show up. But certainly, it's by no means true of all TANF clients. So as they show up, indeed, to make sure that they can participate, we work with them to resolve those issues. But again, no, we don't test everyone.
Have you an estimate as to just rough percentage of TANF recipients that do have drug and alcohol problems?
Mr. Chair, we had done a survey some years ago. I'm not remembering the figure off the top of my head, but I will dig that out and get that answer to you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Monsenderson.
Thank you. How much does a screening, drug and alcohol screening test cost?
Mr. Chair,
and does it cover all kinds of drugs?
Senator Moss Anderson, I don't know that, but since we have contracts for those things, I'll be happy to get you the price for that.
I guess the point is, I was wondering how much of a budget issue
burden that would be.
Yeah, how much of a burden that would be. Yeah.
So yeah, we'd like to have that question. Representative Henson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know how productive this particular fork in the road is going to be. One of the basic problems is you've got people that are suffering from either drug or alcohol problems. Alcohol problems are very prevalent, and yet there's not an effective test for that compared to the
meth, maybe.
Yeah, the things that stay in your system for a longer period of time. The other one is your kind of basic civil liberties, fairness, whatever issues, from a standpoint that there's lots of government services that are provided that we don't drug test for. And the citizens applying for TANF aren't a special class of people that should have a different level of scrutiny than anybody else in society. And I think when we single them out and say, yeah, because you're applying for help from the state, we're automatically suspicious that you have a drug or an alcohol problem, I think that sends a real, real wrong message. On the other hand, tightening up our procedures and stuff so the case managers can, when they suspect that there's a drug problem and it's interfering with people's ability either to take care of their kids or find employment, clearly we need to have a lot of options available for people. And I think that's one more tool. If we want people to get well and healthy, good case management of helping them get showing some hard love at that point and getting them into treatment, I think can be a real, real positive step. But I think it's pretty offensive in terms of someone that's got a good productive record in society and has worked and now has fallen on hard times to automatically subject them to a drug test just to get a basic governmental benefit.
That's my editorial as well as...
I'd like to add to it a counterbalance that if it's a jobs-related program, then it would be assumed that the person ought to be able to get a job. And while I'm not at all concerned about offending somebody's sensitivities, if we are dealing with an absolute epidemic with drugs and we're not winning, then maybe we're going to have to consider other ways to approach it. And I'm not proposing that this just be for TANF, but I was just tossing it out as something to be concerned about or as a possibility. I'm also concerned about life skills. And there are other things that can be required of people. It's not like they're getting an entitlement. They're getting funds from taxpayers, and the taxpayers have a right to, I believe, expect something, you know, some kind of qualification on it. And if drugs is a huge issue that's preventing our society from flourishing or families from going forth, then if, depending on the burden versus the benefit of a ratio, that just things need to be looked at. I'm not recommending anything other than I just was bringing up the subject. Representative Hamm.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up, and I guess I think it's important to note that drug screening in a population outside of law enforcement is not for the purposes of retribution. It's for the purposes of teaching and training for job placement. So you're not doing drug screening as a form of retribution. You're doing drug screening so that you can get them the help they need to get a job. So I think it's just, I mean, in my opinion,
what you're looking at?
It's just the opposite of that. Because if you come to a number of places where you're going to have to take a drug screen to get employment, you ought to know that ahead of time. And why get the job training without being clean in order to get the job? So it's not retribution, it's training, and it's getting people in programs to you know, change a lifestyle that's a major impediment for employment.
My understanding is that right now it's not allowed anyway, that on a Medicaid-related program that you're not allowed to do that kind of testing. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's true on the
required
medical side.
Okay.
I just want to make one more point about this. It might also be pointed out that in many government-related licensing procedures, drug screening is an important part of that, i.e. to have a CDL, you have to pass a drug test.
Which stands for?
Commercial driver's license.
Right.
So that's not the employer saying that, that's the government agency saying that, and there are many, many others. So it's not like it's a new concept.
Right. Okay. Please continue.
Okay, I'll deal with the next two bullets, food stamps, together. Both legislation that was passed at the federal level, the Farm Security and Rural Investment Act and Farm Bill, expanded eligibility for the food stamp program, and that, along with Oregon's label as one of the hungriest states in the country, have caused us to do some outreach in the food stamp program, and the food stamp caseload has grown dramatically, approximately double in the last 6 years. So it's a major budget driver.
Has that solved any problem?
Mr. Chair, I think while we still rank fairly high in terms of USDA study in terms of hunger and food insecurity, the notion that we are now putting about $1.3 million a day onto the plates of hungry Oregonians suggests to me that it has made an impact. And for whatever reasons, Oregon and Washington both have a hunger and food insecurity rate that is out of line with their ranking in terms of poverty. And so there have been considerable looks at why Oregon is as hungry as it's reported to be. A lot of that has to do, some of the theories have to do with the income distribution in Oregon, the housing prices, a lot of external factors. But but certainly $38 million a month coming into the state specifically for food benefits, I believe, has had an impact on that.
Okay, thank you.
And TANF children entering foster care, Mr. Chair, something that you at least alluded to. Over the past 4 years, there has been an increase in children entering the foster care system, having recently been in the Temporary Assistance to Needy Family Programs, either entering directly from TANF or within a year of being on TANF, and currently that's in the neighborhood of 30% of the kids entering the foster care system have been known to us through the TANF caseload. So that's an area that I believe most states have really not paid attention to in terms of looking at that. We've been looking at it over the last year and trying to figure out, are there characteristics that that we can look at that can help us work with some of these TANF families specifically on issues that might bring their kids into foster care. And so we'll be talking a bit more about that as well.
Okay, that's a nice segue into the fact that we also know the increasing number of children coming into foster care in our state are presenting some pretty complex problems for the system, stressing the system in terms of what's available to help those families and those children. And, of course, a primary factor in that is the use of methamphetamine. The increase in parental use of these drugs has, of course, brought new laws and new challenges to the state, as well as to the Department of Human Services. There is legislation. The legislature passed a law stating that we do not have to make efforts to reunify a child with parents if the conduct by the parent that knowingly exposes any child of the parent to the storage or production of methamphetamine, they made that a condition for considering that so egregious that you would not have to work to reunify that particular child with that family. But there are a number of challenges that we are still facing, and one of the things that is interesting about that particular piece of legislation is often the child is not residing with an intact family at the time of the arrest for methamphetamine. So while you may have the grounds then to sever the parental rights of the parent who's involved in making the meth, there may be another parent who is outside of the home, and so it does not automatically mean that you will have a child who is freed for adoption. That's just an interesting side piece to that particular piece of legislation. Some of the challenges, though, are things, children being exposed to meth precursors, where the child, the clothing of the child, contaminates people that come in contact with that. That's a real challenge for our staff as well as for law enforcement. Contamination with the vehicles that are used to transport the children where there's meth being manufactured. And also the children usually need, from those particular environments, need immediate medical help. Some kind of screen to see what all the problems are with that particular child. Those were things that probably 10 years ago we didn't anticipate we'd be seeing in the child welfare system. As a result, we're doing a number of revisions around policies and practices to look at some of the complexity. As you all know, we've had a national expert, Wayne Holder, working with us, and Mr. Holder will be presenting a report May the 12th. But the interesting thing about the meth problem, which is a particular issue to us, is Mr. Holder shared with us that they are working on, the National Resource Center is working on guidelines related to meth and how that's impacting child welfare, how those families should be treated, and so forth. But the guidelines probably are not going to be disseminated until September of this year. So our identification of this problem and the crisis it's creating is a little bit ahead of where the national thinking is, unfortunately, on this particular issue.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Foley, is this rule that... or this recommendation that DHS adopt rules to discontinue the Oregon Trail Card for families who are caught manufacturing meth, is that in place?
Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna, that is not in place, but it is a piece of legislation, I believe, that's pending.
And who is that through?
Which committee
is
that through? The Judiciary Committee, I'm told.
Do you have a bill number by any chance?
We can certainly have one within a few minutes, because that is one we've been tracking.
It has like 70 bills that they're going through right now, trying to put in categories and determine which.
Okay. I want to comment on this, because, again, you know, I guess my question is, why would we take hungry families and take away the food they do get? Why not? I mean, this goes back to the point, I guess, in my mind, I'd much rather test them, and if they got a problem, get them into treatment, rather than if we catch them, take their food away. So I'd like to hear your comment on this particular recommendation.
Chair Richardson and Representative Hanna, we would agree that it's probably not going to solve the problem of families using meth when you think about simply discontinuing that trail card. I think that is a pretty lively discussion in that particular committee. But it's a bit like we were saying earlier. It's a bit like we were saying earlier, discontinuing TANF when you think about the fact that there are children in these families. And so if your recourse is to, if you terminate any assistance for the adult, if that simply means that children then will come into the foster care system, I think we have to think cautiously about what is that public policy, what does that ultimately look like, because today we will also probably get to discussing adoption subsidy, and that's the deep end of the system, and that's the part that I know there's concern in this room about, the sustainability of an adoption subsidy program that continues to grow. And yet, if we want to say at the front end of the system, there are going to be ways of families not receiving the help that you're talking about them receiving, we probably need to prepare for the fact there'll be more adoption subsidy in this state because more children will end up coming into the system. So it's kind of a circular conversation, I think, in this committee, but also in the Judiciary Committee.
Well, it has such far-reaching consequences, and we're dealing with issues that we don't have a lot of knowledge on. For instance, of meth, of families where parents use meth, what percentage of those children become drug users themselves or become juvenile delinquents? And we have had historically, and I fully believe it, that we need to do everything we can to help families stay together. But when drugs take over, does that change that mix? I mean, does it, you know, and I don't have the knowledge to understand the consequences and the percentage of it. I mean, are we better off taking children out? Do parents fail as parents when they become so addicted? And so anyway, they lose their right to continue as parents. These are questions that society has to answer, and the old rules cannot just be assumed to continue because the chemicals, they change things so dramatically.
Do you want to respond to the trail card?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, specifically to your question on the Oregon trail card, I participated in a couple of meetings of one of the meth task force subcommittees looking at this. And in one of those subcommittee meetings, they brought in a couple of folks who were recovering meth addicts. And one woman who's working as a drug treatment counselor now indicated, when asked specifically, well, would it make a difference if we threatened to take away your Oregon Trail card? And her response was, I lost my job, I lost my husband, I lost my kids because of meth, and do you think that taking away my Oregon Trail card would have made me stop when those other things didn't? So at least from her point of view, it would not have impacted her behavior. Finally, she had to hit bottom and end up in jail before she was at a point where she could do something about her addiction. But indeed, I think, particularly with meth, it once the addiction takes hold, it's really no longer a choice.
Well, a little facetious, but I think from my view of a lot of meth addicts, food doesn't seem to be a real high priority. But these are the incredibly tough decisions to try and wrestle with from a standpoint. Nobody on this side of the dais or probably in this room wants to see families impacted by meth and want to see kids impacted by it. On the other hand, if you take the card away, do the kids not get the food? Which is a incredibly ugly, unforeseen circumstance. The other one is if we're trying to get the parents off drugs and get them into treatment and into a productive lifestyle, the more you isolate them, taking them out of food stamps, taking them out of TANF, while they're suffering from the addiction, they're not going to come forward. they're not going to apply for food stamps. They're not going to apply for TANF if they know that they're facing extra scrutiny, which keeps them isolated from maybe some of the most some of the only positive non-drug culture links to society. And on the other hand, we sure don't want to see somebody using an Oregon Trail card to trade food for mm-hmm. drugs.
Or just with the card, just cashing it in for cash. But kind of
well,
it's hard to do that.
So we need to. I think probably there's some clarification on that, because in some cases there's cash, but on straight food stamps, I don't think.
No, you're correct on food stamps, but on TANF payments, am I correct that TANF payments are cash payment and that the card can be utilized like a credit card?
Mr. Chair, for the TANF side, which admittedly is a very small piece of Oregon Trail card use, that's correct, that it is in lieu of a check. With food stamp benefits, they cannot cash those out.
Anyway, these have financial consequences. We're not just dealing with mm-hmm. this as a policy issue. The decisions made in this area will determine the funding that needs to be allocated in different areas of adult and, children and adult families. And I don't think we're there yet. I mean, where we can say, well, this is the conclusion that we've reached there. There is going to be an increase in foster care because we're pulling children out of families involved with drugs sooner. And so, we need extra money to prepare for that. And I mean, how do you ramp up when we don't even know fully what we're dealing with?
Chair Richardson, to your point, you're correct in that we don't have a body of national evidence-based research right now that tells us what we should be doing differently with families when meth is the presenting problem. We anticipate that the national expert, when those guidelines come out, they are going to say to us, this is a clear and present danger immediately for a child. Beyond that, though, I think they're also perplexed by what's the prognosis. How do you tell which families are going to be successful in treatment? Some families obviously are successful in treatment. But we know less about this particular drug, I think, and the impact than you might know. For example, we're talking earlier about alcoholism. That's been well researched. We know some things that work around alcoholics and those kinds of problems. But this is a different problem, and you're right. It's very hard to predict exactly how we're going to handle the result of the problem without knowing some more about what the prognosis is going to be and what things are effective.
Representative Hansen.
Well, further digress, but as we've talked about the case manager, the staffing study, case manager numbers, if we're relying on our case managers to be the link and be the person that gets these families into treatment, how much direct drug information training do our case managers get? How many hours a year? I mean, we're talking about a really complicated area for people that aren't specialists in that field.
Chair Richardson and Representative Hansen, what we try to do is train our workers to know what some of the obvious signs are of drug use, but primarily it's a team approach where they're working with their alcohol and drug counterparts there locally. And in some parts of the state, those individuals are co-housed with the child welfare staff. And that's become a pretty prominent model around the state, so that one worker links to the worker in the alcohol and drug community to be able to say, this is what I see as the problem. Can you help me figure out whether or not this is someone we need to send for referral? And often the presenting information that comes in will say right up front at the intake, this person is using meth. This person we know from the neighborhood or from collaterals we suspect is using meth. So, but you're right in that we have to make sure we don't see our own caseworker as being the expert in this area. They have to be the expert in who to call and who to get the kind of medical information they may need to have out of the alcohol and drug system for a particular family.
Now we need to move on. I just mention that I've been meeting with different people from relief nurseries and talking to them about the success that they're having in dealing with addicted families, and it has been one bright area of hope because of the time spent with adults with families where they kind of will have someone who will be there. I mean, it's kind of like a blending from what I've seen of AAA and other things where you have somebody that's checking up with someone and giving them support and encouragement while other parts of the family's needs are being dealt with as well, but it's kind of a holistic approach rather than a, you know, do you qualify, do you not qualify, or whatever. And there's just, I know everybody's concerned about it, and there's different ways to approach it, but at least in one small area that seems to be functioning pretty well.
And Chair Richardson, in answer to the question about the trail card, it's Senate Bill 909, and what it would do is deny food stamp benefits under certain circumstances to persons who've been convicted of certain drug-related felonies.
That's a unique approach.
Woo.
Well, okay, thank you.
You're welcome. The critical incident response team protocol that was mentioned earlier by Ms. Dean, that's something we put in place and activated in December with two cases, as you're aware. And it's giving us a lot of information, has given us a lot of information about the child welfare system to the point that we're thinking we probably need to look at how to look at a case with that same level of detail even when there's not a bad outcome on that case. And so one of the things we are talking about is a quality assurance system that might actually take some of what we're learning out of the CERTS, the critical incident response team, and applying some of that kind of scrutiny to our system prior to there being a reason for there to be a CERT. Special needs foster children, we've talked about that in phase one, some of the complex special needs, and again, about half the children coming into foster care qualify for special rates. We've had a work group looking at a redesign of what that special rate system might look like. What are some of the options so that we don't continue to grow the expectation that special rate payments are going to be there? For 50% of the children, that number could go up or down. We know that, so we've looked at some management actions to exercise trying to get some control over that, but the reality, of course, is some of those children will continue to require very special care in foster families so that they don't go into more expensive residential type of placements.
What do you think will be the consequences if the governor's proposed changes in compensation to foster parents were to be adopted?
Chair Richardson, what we hope to do is use that, if that were to stay in place, we will use that as a management action to try to say across the state, here is the amount of what this budget's going to be. As managers, as our SDA managers look at this, they have to be able then to work within what that allocation might be based on the number of children in foster care, perhaps the number of children who are receiving special rates now. But it's one of those things where I believe we would try to supplement, perhaps instead of a cash payment for a special rate payment, if we could supplement with a service so that the service is supplied when the service is needed, and then when the service is no longer needed, the service is taken away. It's very difficult when you're using a special rate for the family to purchase that service. It's difficult to take the special rate away because the child is still the same child, and it's sort of the reverse award system, because as the child gets better, we're saying to you as the foster parent, you've done such a great job, you no longer qualify for the special rate, even though it's the same child and many of the behaviors are there. We would use that as a management action to look to see what is the best and most humane way to do this, because I will tell you, you'll probably hear some public testimony Tuesday from some extraordinary foster parents in the state who do incredible work, and I know some of you are familiar with some of the medical foster home, those homes that serve kids who are medically dependent and would be in residential care. Legal representation, and I think we talk about that a few minutes in when we get to the policy packages, but this is one that I think really would help us define a different way of doing business. Right now, as many of you know, our caseworkers go into court, and the agency does not have legal representation in the majority of the hearings, and yet very serious decisions are being made in the courtroom in terms of whether or not children get returned home, whether or not children are going to proceed to a path towards adoption. And we are probably the only state in the nation that will allow a caseworker to go in and testify on behalf of the agency, more or less representing the agency. It has the appearance of practicing law without a license, because our caseworkers prepare petitions, they cross-examine witnesses, they do a number of tasks that would not be allowed in other states. And so we will get into some more detail about that and answer some questions you probably have about that particular package. For eligibility is what we garner, how we garner our federal. I see a question, maybe.
Mr. Chair, I want to know what our process is here. This is an area I want to ask some questions about.
Yeah, but are we still doing an overview? I mean,
this is still the overview. It's gone a little longer. I'm sorry.
I have an opportunity later. I don't want to slow you down. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, let's get to the overview.
Okay. 4E eligibility is how we gain our federal dollars for children in the foster care system. Just a heads up that we have another audit coming on that this fall. We successfully passed the last audit, but the stakes get higher. You have to be able to pass more and more cases. And basically it means you have to have an eligible child and you have to have an eligible home in order to qualify that case to be 4E eligible. There's already been mention of the SACWIS system. Which is our automated database system, and that's in the department-wide package. Some improvements we have to make in that, and you see there that we'll be expected to refund some federal dollars. If we were not able to comply with those requirements, that would probably be in the tune of neighborhood of about $9 million in federal funds that we have drawn down to try to build that system.
Vocational rehabilitation programs are also pending reauthorization of their primary legislation, the Workforce Investment Act, and I think we've seen some things in at least early versions of that that suggest there may be some funding issues for them as well in terms of required support for one-stop employment shops and perhaps more requirements around funding youth transition, which would divert funds that they have now. So that's something we'll talk a bit more about later.
And then finally, in this section of the overview, we have a number of advocacy groups we work with. Several of those are created by statute. And the reason we put it on this for budget drivers is all of our advocacy groups don't necessarily agree on everything that comes forth as a proposed policy and so forth. So we want to honor that, though, because we think that's an important part of our process here in Oregon. I came from a state that did not really have advisory groups and advocacy committees, and so for me this has been an important way of making sure we stay connected to other people who are out there in the field advocating for certain groups across CAF. Other major changes in children, adults, and families, and this is more of a kind of a historical of how we got to where we are. As you all probably know, in 1995, the agency entered into a settlement agreement with the Juvenile Rights Project and the National Center for Youth Law. And we continue to work under this agreement, and it gives us markers as to how successful we are in terms of the treatment of children who are in the foster care system. This was the alternative to moving to something more drastic, like a class action suit. And a number of states around the country, as you know, are in the middle of class action suits related to their child welfare systems. In 1996, of course, welfare reform impacted the programs here because the AFDC, the old Aid to Families and Dependent Children program, was replaced by temporary assistance to needy families.
Ramona, can we skip over this part?
We certainly can. Thank you. We'll talk a little bit about the special actions to contain cost.
Okay. There are a number of things that we have done to try and essentially maximize federal funding wherever we can find that. A couple of good examples are Title IV-E or foster care waiver have allowed us to spend what would have been foster care dollars that could only be spent on children who actually had entered the foster care system, enabled us to spend that money to keep kids out of the foster care system instead. And that was recently renewed for an additional 5 years, and so that's a substantial boon to the state. Targeted case management, something we started actually in 1992, $105 million in the past biennium of federal fund that would have been general fund in terms of some of the basic program stuff that we do. As was mentioned earlier, and we'll have probably a more thorough discussion of this as we get into the field and caseload, we did not request earned caseload positions, and we can detail that for you later in terms of the what's filled and what wasn't filled. And I think from there, probably to get this moved, if we go to page 15, we can talk in a bit more detail about package 090 and the adjustments. Now, Sheila has gone through these in some level of detail, and I I don't know if the committee would like to spend more time on these specific pieces that at the governor's recommended budget level were not able to be funded. And if that's not the case, then we can go directly into the packages that we're going to talk about.
Let's shut up for just a minute.
Mr. Chair, the agency has given us replacement pages for pages 9 and 10 and pages 15 to 16, so I'll hand those out now.
Okay. Additional changes made to
and if you want to leave your binders or at the close of the meeting, if you want me to put these in the binders in the right place, then I can do that as well.
We can do that. What's the difference in the pages?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While she was passing those out, could we have a brief description of the differences? Why are we getting new pages? What's the difference?
I wish they would announce that at the beginning, because they down there can see where you're looking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, apparently all the text didn't appear on the original version. There should be no changes in the numbers. This is just reprinting to fix what was text error.
Okay, now you've directed us to package 090, and so why don't we look at that? Delay implementation inflation factors. That's saving $9.8 million.
Okay, so correct.
We're just. Now is that
rather than implementing inflation factors that would, for instance, improve payments to foster care families at the beginning of the biennium, this pushes it back so that there's a smaller expenditure to make up for the cost of inflation over the biennium.
Okay, so it's delaying increases in payments that normally would have occurred to foster parents?
Foster parents and other providers within the department.
Okay. At first, I just want to understand it. Then reduction to cap administrative costs, $16 million. Where are those cuts coming from?
This is all in administrative funding. It is primarily in staffing, although there's some service and supply and I believe some capital outlay in this as well. But the bulk of this is 81 positions that, rather than produce additional program cuts, we decided it would be better for us to cut additional positions and save what we could in terms of other program reductions.
Okay, how has the agency been able to do that and still maintain the delivery of service?
Mr. Chair, in fact, at this point, we haven't done that, but assuming that stays as is, this will be spread in several program areas.
Okay, now, is this what we're talking about when Sheila was going over 82 positions and then 80 field personnel? Is this the same discussion?
Mr. Chair, yes, although there are two issues around about 80, two different issues around 80 positions. We'll get to the other one later in the list here. This is one where some of these positions are currently filled, and either through attrition or layoff, we would reduce those. Some of those are other positions that we have earned up to this biennium but have not been filled.
All right,
that's a combination of filled and unfilled currently.
Mr. Chair, I would just note the difference between the 81 positions in this package and the 82 that I referred to is the fact that one of the positions came out in a different package. The budget and management analyst took it out in, I believe it was the 010 package or something. So I netted those two together, but that's why you only see 81 here, but it is the same issue.
Okay, so I think your comment was that most of these positions are not currently filled, and so I guess, you know, since we're kind of drilling down a little bit, I'm just wondering, of these 82 positions, do you know how many of them are currently filled, and of that amount, you know, what will happen to those folks?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the number currently filled now. although in terms of what will happen to those folks, since most of them would be in the case manager, social service specialist arena as well as support staff, because there are other position reductions at the governor's recommended budget for seniors and persons with disabilities that you hear about later, and because there is, if in case of a layoff, there is essentially cross-bumping between clusters. To the extent we can, we'll deal with this through attrition. To the extent that we cannot deal with it through attrition, there could be layoff, and folks can bump back and forth across clusters and ultimately end up at lower levels as there are vacancies. If there are not vacancies, indeed it becomes a layoff for some individuals.
How does that work as far as training is concerned? Because not everybody has the same experience or training.
Mr. Chair, it's very difficult and disruptive when we have to do this. Training among the issues, as you mentioned, and while case managers in the adult arena share some training with case managers in self-sufficiency or child welfare, they're pretty different disciplines. The basic idea is that in order to bump into another classification or displace someone with lower service credits, you have to be able to understand the job and learn the job quickly, as opposed to having no experience in that arena at all. And there's some pretty detailed requirements around that. But indeed, the training issue, what it does to morale, it has lasting effects when we have to do that. That's why we prefer to do this through attrition when we can.
Okay. All right. Representative Henson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is where that staffing study could be really helpful, because it would be, one, I'd like to see the breakdown between the different, you know, how many of these are TANF managers, how many are food stamp intake managers. And then also seeing how much, it always seems simple for us not to fill empty positions. But if you're incurring overtime costs because of these, or if food stamps aren't being eligibility isn't being determined in a timely manner and meeting the federal qualifications, if you don't have enough people to do the job, you incur some other kinds of costs. And I, as much information as we can get, short of the staffing study, or maybe making a final decision on this after the preliminary draft is available for us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we have and can give you the detail in terms of where the positions are, and I think by the end of the day we'll lay that out for you. And you're absolutely right, both in terms of the staffing study, trying to figure out what people have the capacity to do versus what we're asking them to do. But then, again, looking at, you know, what are we going to do with staffing versus what are we going to do with program cuts? Very difficult decisions. And do we save staffing by further reducing programs? It's not a good choice in either event.
Okay. Do you want to make a comment on the limit food stamps offset program, $1 million?
Mr. Chair, we'll get into this a bit later when we talk about the food stamp program. We believe within the federal requirement to have a food stamp employment and training program, if we limit it to transportation, it will still be a viable program. We'll save money. We won't get the same kinds of outcomes we'd like to have, but a reasonable choice to make.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Question on that. As I understand it, food stamp intake people can exempt people from the offset program. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, in the food stamp program especially, there are rather a lot of potential exemptions, and people can volunteer for it even if they are otherwise exempt. But indeed, unlike the TANF program where there are very few exemptions, The food stamp employment and training program has been historically underfunded, and while on the one hand the federal government has at least paid some homage to the notion of getting people employed and off of the food stamp program, it's been actually more of a boutique operation from that point of view, as opposed to the focus of the program that it has been in the TANF program.
I guess my thought would be, if by examining the criteria of why people either receive the exemption or not receive the exemption, are we sending people to the offset program that probably aren't going to get a benefit from it? And would a better way to reduce the cost of the program be by sending fewer people to it, or being very selective in terms of who we send to it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson, excuse me, that's essentially how we would do this. For instance, one of the support services that we wouldn't cover would be child care. Folks that have child care needs would probably be exempt from the program, and rather than encouraging them to join the program when we can't pay child care expenses, which they need to participate, we wouldn't send them to the program. We wouldn't encourage them to participate. So that's really the approach that we take.
Mm-hmm. Helpful.
Top of the next page, page 16, no longer funding research activities of Portland State except as required to maintain our 4E waiver. There are some other research activities they've done for us in the past, for instance, looking at our practice issues that, while on one hand it would be nice if we could continue those, we found a way to save some money in that regard. We'll probably talk substantially more about lower level funding for jobs and for voc rehab services. No longer funding the homemaker program. This is one where initially, as we talked about the reduction here, we anticipated that the individuals that do this would no longer be funded in the Portland area that was very much underutilizing these services to begin with. Through a technical mishap, the entire amount of the homemaker program was included in the reduction. So Portland was the largest, but there are now other areas of the state as well that would no longer have the homemaker program. Once we discovered that technical problem, we looked at it and tried to decide, well, do we need to find other cuts to restore the other areas of the state that we didn't intend to cut, and determined that there probably were no easier cuts to be found than that, so we left that one alone.
I've been contacted on that, and I've indicated that it is not to be assumed that that entire program is going to be cut.
And Mr. Chair, originally we didn't assume that either, but unfortunately the entire amount got included.
I mean, I'm saying it publicly so that it's not a done deal. Okay. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why was the program underutilized in the Portland area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, I'm not sure I can give you a good answer off the top of my head there. It's a service that is available, and my belief is that for whatever reason, folks that Portland area was dealing with did not feel this was a service that was necessary, as opposed to other services that they had to engage families with. We'll talk to them and get a little better idea of why they think it was underfunded. It might have a different twist to it.
Okay.
This also proposes lowering the reimbursement limit for non-recurring adoption expenses from $2,000 to $1,500, and we'll talk more about that as we get into the adoption area. Reduce funding on system of care. We felt we could still have a viable program, but reduce the general fund in that regard. And we'll also talk more about system of care as we get into that program area. TANF no parent income standard, as Sheila indicated, currently for the group of folks receiving temporary assistance to needy families where there are eligible children, but there is not an eligible adult in probably most cases, another caretaker relative caring for the child. We don't take their income into account, but rather we base the TANF grant on just the children alone. This proposes to put that income standard in there, and we'll talk specifically more about that standard and how we got to it as we talk about the TANF program more. Eliminating funding from VR for seniors and people with disabilities employment readiness program, part of the seniors employment package, was something funded through VR, and we're proposing discontinuing that. Sheila mentioned eliminating the minimum copay for employment-related daycare for the first month to help people stabilize employment before they begin paying their full share on the sliding scale copayment, employment-related daycare. That's an important one, but probably not as significant as limiting eligibility to the families who are leaving. This cuts off leaving TANF, but that's indeed what the reduction would be, and we'll talk in some more detail about that as we get to employment-related daycare. Prevention services, there are a couple of different cuts in there that we'll specifically get to as we move into the prevention service area. Reduction in emergency assistance domestic violence program, another one that's difficult to reduce. We proposed a 15% reduction in that. Eliminate staffing related to mandatory caseload increases. That's 80 positions that we did not ask for that ordinarily would be presumed in the governor's recommended budget. Lower the special needs. We've already talked about that a bit for special needs foster care. Accessing cash balances in the Jobs Plus individual education account and the law enforcement medical liability account. Those are two areas that indeed take by statute, they go somewhere else now. The balances in the Jobs Plus individual education accounts after 5 years of dormancy, not being used by the people that earned them, transfer to the Student Assistance Commission for, I believe it's the Opportunity Grant or the Need Grant. They changed the name on that.
Representative Henson.
On your reductions on the domestic violence program funding, how are you implementing that? Fewer people or reduce the amount of funding per case or what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Henson, it would probably be a combination approach. Right now there's a $1,200 maximum. We might look at reducing that maximum dollar amount, as well as what we have done in the recent past in terms of increased scrutiny for those cases that are repeaters in terms of this. In the original emergency assistance program, that program was available only once a year, once in a 12-month period. When the domestic violence emergency assistance program was split off, when the program was bifurcated, we allowed multiple access to that program within a year. We found that by further scrutinizing that, we've been able to, I think, reasonably reduce the cost of that somewhat. So we'll review how we review those multiple expenditures in that program as well. Ultimately, I believe we'd probably have to reduce the maximum amount payable. The last piece is just a small technical adjustment. And with that, I'd propose that we go to package 103 on page 17. And this is a package that you'll probably spend most of your time discussing with the health cluster, but it's in our arena as well because of the staffing that's associated with that.
Any questions on the 090, any of these items that you want to go into right now? Or, okay, let's go ahead then. What page?
17. Page 17, the bottom half of the page. And this is the package that restores the Oregon Health Plan standard population. Right now, that interim program is operating with limited duration positions. This would standardize that given the managed care tax and the hospital tax, and this would, from the CAP perspective, provides the staffing to continue to operate that.
Would you remind us as to what happened and how did you went from the organized standard population. I know what happened to the population, how it decreased, but I didn't know that there was a major shift in the way that you staffed it. I mean, how did we get to temporary?
Mr. Chair, what happened was that basically the general fund was eliminated from the standard program and the positions abolished while we were pending federal approval for the managed care and hospital tax. And when that was approved and we realized we could continue to run a reduced health plan standard program, I believe it was November e-board that we got the limited duration positions to maintain that as opposed to continuing to just shut it down. So this package brings back the entire program and for our purposes funds the 25 staff to maintain those 24,000 roughly families that would be eligible or individuals.
Are these the same people that were there before, but there was a change in status?
Mr. Chair, some of those same folks are around. Others moved on to other jobs or left the department. There's always been a fair amount of turnover in that program.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
If I remember right, initially you had a large number of employees running a program that was close to 100,000. We didn't know we were going to drop the whole program or not. Made it temporary, and now you're at sort of a steady state. You know roughly where you're going to be as far as the number of people in the program, and you've got an appropriate match as far as employees are concerned to run enough staff. I think that's overall that's the big picture on this thing. What was your number when you had 100,000 people in the program? That were how many positions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I believe we had in the neighborhood of twice that many folks running the program, but we'll get you the specific number.
I think it's for the discussion here so people can understand what happened. As the program was ramped down, we used temporary people because we weren't sure where we were going to end up as far as numbers in the program, and what you're asking for is a reduced number but now making permanent because we think the program is going to be going on forward from this point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we believe based on what we anticipate from the tax revenues that 24,000 is about the level that could be sustained by those. Still no general fund in the program, and we believe this is about the staffing level required to do that in a responsible manner.
Okay.
Okay. Chair Richardson, package 104, we're back to the Attorney General representation for child welfare in court hearings. And what this package attempts to do is, from our perspective, we're trying to get caseworkers refocused on doing casework, trying to limit the amount of time that they're having to spend doing those tasks that are associated with attorney work and preparing for court and being in court. They would still be in court, but they'd be the witness on the case as opposed to presenting the case.
There's a lot of cost involving having DOJ attorneys do this, and I understand, you know, the concern that you have. But have other ways of delivering this service been looked at?
Chair Richardson, it's my understanding that the way the statute is written, that the Attorney General's office is the place that's required to do legal services for the Department of Human Services. So we personally have not spent time trying to see what are the other options for getting attorney work done. That may be something that in the Judiciary Committee, the package was presented. There are two companion packages. We have one, and then the Attorney General's office, Department of Justice, has a package, and that was presented to Senator Gordley's committee recently. So that's not something we would research, but I understand what your question is.
Well, you've got 36 counties. I'm wondering, are there DOJ attorneys in every county, in every office?
Chair Richardson, they are not. And the way this package would be implemented, right now we have Department of Justice representation in approximately 5% of our dependency cases. This package simply takes us to 15% representation. It does not take us to 100% representation. We asked Department of Justice how many attorneys that would take if we were able to do this in 100% of the cases as it's done in child welfare in other states, and they were projecting approximately 37 attorneys and three supervising attorneys plus some support staff. So what you see here is a package that we have pieced together where the Department of Justice would be with us in cases that critical decisions are being made, and those would be some criteria like the child is about to be returned home or a decision is being made that this child now has a concurrent plan and is going to move towards adoption. Those are very critical decisions in terms of what hangs in the balance. And the package, from our perspective, would add legal assistants and paralegals and legal secretaries so that much of the work that's being done right now by our staff would actually be moved onto the plates of those legal assistants and paralegals. They would work for the Department of Human Services. There is a better administrative match by them being housed in the Department of Human Services, but they would actually be trained and be taking supervision from the Department of Justice attorneys. So it's not the maximum package. It's not the best that we ultimately want to do. We think it is a step to move us in the direction of doing this business differently, to have our workers step out of the role of pretending to be attorneys, to be making recommendations to court that should be made only on the basis of the law having been considered. I think it's a way of tightening, adding precision to our child welfare system that's overdue and probably became much more critical for us with the passage of the Adoption and Safe Families Act. Prior to that, I've given this quite a bit of thought because it was unusual when I came to Oregon to find that we didn't have legal representation. And keeping in mind that Oregon has a national reputation for mediation, for non-adversarial approaches to handling matters. In fact, that's one of the things Oregon's known most for nationally. And it would be easy to see how in child welfare, in a different climate, the worker would come in, would simply present to the judge, this is the status of the case, this is what's happening with the child and with the foster family, and there wasn't a sense of urgency about that system. And then when the federal law passed, the Adoption and Safe Families Act, and the state adapted legislation to match that, all of a sudden we're talking about critical time frames for families to get their children back out of the system. We're talking about critical decisions at the front end as to whether or not children need to come into care. And those kinds of time frames are not something that generally our child welfare workers have the competency to go into court and represent to the court from the agency's perspective that we have followed the law. And now with all due process being attached to those cases, we're making recommendations to the court. I think it is extremely serious. And while I know that the timing probably is, there's never a good time to ask for anything in addition, but this is one where we looked and talked with our own staff. 31 of the positions that we would be giving up are casework-related positions because we believe immediately that amount of time would be saved by having legal staff doing the work that our caseworkers are spending their time doing. It also makes it hard in terms of accountability because we're holding our caseworkers responsible for doing the job of caseworkers, like going out and making face-to-face visits, working with families. But if workers are spending their time in this judicial process, they're not able to get the other work done that they're trying to do in their caseloads.
Mr. Chair. Agencies received a letter from the Oregon District Attorneys Association that I have copies for members, and I'll pass that out. Yeah.
Chair?
Senator Bates.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and Ramona, I've got a couple questions for you. This is something you know I'm extremely concerned about and have been watching carefully, and I appreciate your efforts on this. I am not an attorney. I'm somewhat concerned, however, that the state has some liability here, that we could be sued by a family or other member of or an organization saying we're not practicing appropriately here. We're practicing essentially law without a license, and that the state's been not properly represented. I'd like to have a comment from you on that. I also am concerned that as a purchaser of legal services, you have the ability and authority to purchase those services where you can get it at the best price, which may not be the state. If we need statutory change for that, we should think about that as a possibility. We've already gone through a situation where people didn't use the, this is a very different thing, but it's at a certain parallel to it, where agencies stopped using the motor pool in the state because it was more expensive than getting it from Hertz. I'm not recommending that we look at it from that point of view, but there is a certain parallel there.
By the way, I think that Ms. Fuller is not in a position to do that. This has been brought up. You're absolutely correct. But for one agency to be recommending that possibly we ought to have more economical private attorneys that have a direct effect on DOJ, so that's something we need to do.
That's what I'm saying. If you need legislative relief, then that we should be looking at that. I mentioned that just a moment ago. Yeah. Third thing, and most importantly to me, is what has this done to the children? We have children sitting in the system, which my sense is that without attorneys working these cases, it delays the cases, delays decisions that are vital for those children, either to get them back in their families or to move them on to a foster home and ultimately an adoptive service or directly to an adoptive service. And that's the real shame in this. The fact that we are the only state that doesn't do this makes me think that the 49 states are not all wrong and that maybe we're the outlier, just wildly thinking here. So could you comment on all those real quickly for us?
Yes, Chair Richardson and Senator Bates. In terms of your first question, there has been litigation in the state of Utah. My understanding is part of their class action lawsuit related to foster care was related to the fact that they did not have legal counsel on their cases. And we checked this about 6 months ago, and at that point they are building that into their child welfare system as a condition of their class action suit. I certainly appreciate Chair Richardson's sensitivity to my role not to request statutory changes for other parts of state government. I think that this is an area the Department of Justice and Attorney General Hardy Myers has worked very closely with us, and I think that's a conversation that perhaps he would be better able to have with the committee or with the Judiciary Committee as you all see fit. And then thirdly, the children in the system, we have depended in our state on the kindness, really, of the district attorneys. The DAs across the state generally are going into court initially on cases because many of our cases, as you know, overlap with law enforcement and child welfare. But they really do not have the capacity to sustain those cases after children remain in care, after jurisdictional hearings. And so pretty much what you have then is this gap in which we begin handling the case and we begin handling the legal issues related to the case. And you are right, it has huge implications for cases not moving quickly. It has huge implications. It was mentioned in our federal review 3 years ago as one of the reasons that we're not able to expedite returning children home quickly or expedite permanency through some other means of getting children out of the system. And it seems that with the volume of children coming into the system now, it's one of those ways that I think we really have to think of how we're doing our business and consider doing our business differently with this regard.
Mr. Chair, follow up and I'll stop at that point. Ramona, have you seen cases where you go into court and the judge has said to you or said to your caseworker, you are not an attorney. What are you doing in this court? We need an attorney handling this case. I mean, if I went to court and tried to represent somebody else, like other than myself, I don't think, number one, I'd be competent. I know I wouldn't be competent, but I don't think I'd be allowed to do that. I don't think a judge would allow me to do that.
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, we do have judges, and I think you will be given at least some written testimony from a judge who has followed this issue for several years. Judges in certain parts of the state are concerned to the point that they are saying to us, I can't allow the caseworker to come back into court unless there's going to be DOJ representation with that worker, because it has reached that level, and they are concerned, I think, as a group. They are concerned about the seriousness of the recommendations being made and what hangs in the balance whenever that recommendation perhaps ends up being a bad outcome in a particular case, and we do have that happen.
You know, as you go over this, as an attorney, you know, I'm considering it from a number of aspects. One is that there's a difference between the normal circuit court process and juvenile court. Historically, it's been that way. It's been much more informal. There is a judge there who's very knowledgeable and who doesn't allow a person to just have inadequate information merely because they don't have an attorney. I understand that, you know, that it would be good to have an attorney there. You know, we're looking at $4+ million for this with DOJA attorneys to get 10% more than what you have right now, which if you're at 5%, you want to go to 15%, that means, if the logic is correct, 85% are still not being dealt with.
And yet this has been something that we've been doing for decades, for generations. And so I'm trying to understand what has changed now that would make it so important to have a lawyer who, by the way, is very busy doing multiple things and has most of the stuff is done by the staff anyway. And so he gets a case, goes through it very quickly, and comes in and represents it, but doesn't have the time to do the in-depth work that your caseworker does. A caseworker, in essence, is like a paralegal in this instance because they know more about this one aspect of it than do the lawyers who handle, you know, 100 different things. And so, I mean, I'm taking all those things into consideration, and I don't want the staff practicing without a license, but it's also not like a normal practice of law in that you're coming to a family judge juvenile situation. So, you know, we're going to have to talk more about this. We're out of time. If Representative Hansen has...
Chair Richardson, if I may, though, the thing that has changed that I really want to emphasize is the federal law and now the state law, because we never had those time frames in the foster care system where you stand to lose your child permanently if your child has been in care 15 of the last 22 months. So I think that really is important to know that that is different, and that has changed how these cases are going through juvenile court.
Okay, we'll need to talk about it. Again, in more detail, the issues are the same. The time frame is different. And
yes.
So whether it's been 3 years before you get into that hearing or 15 months before you get into the hearing, once you're there, the issues are the same.
Yes.
And so, it's a time frame thing, and so I'm still trying to sort that out. Representative Hansen.
Well, a couple just real quick things. One, very clearly the Attorney General is the legal representative of the state, but I don't think there's anything that would preclude the Attorney General from contracting this workout. They would have to be making the decision. I mean, that's kind of the reason we have an Attorney General, is to guide the legal decisions of the state. But I think if there was a cost-effective way for them to contract it out, they could. One concern I have is if we have attorneys in the room representing the child.
Now the attorneys all show up.
Well, are we then under an obligation, or are we already under an obligation to provide public defender services for the parents?
Chair Richardson and Representative Hansen, in fact, parents generally have an attorney, and the child has an attorney. The agency is generally the place that does not have an attorney. So any kinds of settlement conferences, the agency generally is not considered a party of that because we have no legal representation. That's one of the ways we think this would expedite some of these cases moving more quickly. But often we have workers who came and testified to Representative Dalto's committee who said, you go into court and you might be the only person there who doesn't have an attorney, and the judge is really not going to be that interested in your presentation versus what's being presented by the attorneys representing all the other parties. Okay. So it's a good question.
The other issue would be, within the scope of your agency, could you create job positions of paralegals and use that as a support staff for your caseworkers?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hansen, we create in this policy package, that's what we create by giving up 31 positions and adding additional 42. I'm close on the numbers, I think. There are about 73 positions that do the kind of work that Chair Richardson is describing that don't really require an attorney level of competence to do, but it's the paralegal, those ongoing parts of preparing for court, making sure notices are done, making sure evidence is being gathered, and it would just take that off the plates of our frontline caseworkers so they could do casework and do social work.
Okay, with that, why don't we continue this tomorrow? I would like to have you come in and make sure that we're prepared to discuss in detail package 119 on the costs and collections, because I'm concerned about the money that's being spent and the money that's being recovered and whether or not that might be more effectively done by those that are professional in that regard. So without further ado, we will adjourn.
Dennis, we have a question.